Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, the ACLU has been preparing for Election Day threats to voting and vote counting for years. Sophia Lynn Lakin, director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project, will explain. But first, Kamala's closing argument. Bhaskar Sunkara has some evidence about what works. That's coming up in a minute. What can Kamala do to strengthen her closing argument for the working class? For example, in Pennsylvania. If she wins there, she probably wins the election. Pennsylvania has a working class majority. Voters without four-year degrees account for 62% of the electorate there. 50% of eligible voters are blue-collar whites. So what do we know about working class political views in Pennsylvania? For that, we turn to Bhaskar Sunkara. He's president of The Nation magazine, founding editor of Jacobin, author of the book The Socialist Manifesto, regular contributor to The Guardian, also writes for The New York Times, The Washington Post, lots of other places. Bhaskar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, Biden carried Pennsylvania by 80,000 votes, just a fraction above 50%. The polling averages for Pennsylvania this week, for what they're worth, have the candidates basically tied. Trump himself has been so crazy and dangerous, it makes it very easy for Harris to take the safe route and draw contrast between a competent establishment leader and a dangerous potential tyrant. But new research suggests she could do better than that. Tell us about this new study from the Center for Working Class Politics and Jacobin. What I like about it is you were not asking what issues concern you the most, the economy, immigration, etc.
Yeah, I think this study is unique in that it's a study that, by the way, I was not an author of the study. I am on the board of the Center for Working Class Politics, and obviously I'm the founding editor of Jacobin, which helped publish this study. But together with YouGov, the Center for Working Class Politics designed a survey that tested key messaging approaches among 1,000 voters in Pennsylvania. So the main goal was to test which of Harris's actual messaging styles perform best in this state. Then the goal was to also test whether Harris's messages could be improved.
What was the number one finding?
The number one finding was that messaging around Trump as a threat to democracy is the weakest way to attack Trump. And unfortunately, it's also the way in which Harris has approached her final couple weeks of the campaign. The strongest message we tested was around populist economics, and that got support of 58% of the respondents, while the threat to democracy message received just 49% support. In August, there were signs that she was adopting a populist message of some type. This is a message that we tried to replicate in the survey, and we call this soft populist messaging. That messaging had the support of 54% of respondents, as opposed to 36% that opposed it.
What did this study suggest should be the strong populist economic message that Harris is presenting to working class voters in Pennsylvania?
Well, John, let me quote from the message text that performed the strongest, and that'll give you a real sense of what we're talking about. It reads, "Let's call it like it is. Working class Americans are struggling while billionaires just get richer. We're paying too much for gas, groceries, and even the medicine we need. It's time we stand up to big corporations and the politicians in Washington who serve them. I'll fight to cap prescription drug costs, crack down on price gouging, make sure corporations pay their fair share, and end tax breaks for billionaire crooks. It's time to put working families first.
What was the difference between the soft populism that Harris has articulated in her campaign and what you call strong populism?
Strong populist economic messaging basically just goes beyond the rhetoric that talks about the working class deserving more. And it places more of an emphasis on the takers and redefining the takers as, unlike Trump's populism, where the takers are immigrants and minorities, this redefines it as billionaires and people benefiting from the corrupt system. So basically similar to the current populist messaging, but a little bit more intentionally polarizing.
And you also distinguish it between Harris's message around the economics, which you call a moderate economic message, focusing on the opportunity economy, and what you call a strong economic message.
Yeah, a strong economic message puts a greater emphasis on redistribution. It puts a greater emphasis on manufacturing policies, creates a greater emphasis on reshoring American jobs, on a jobs guarantee, on expanding Medicare access, and so on. So it basically takes a lot of the existing policies that we've seen under the Biden administration, and it melds it with some demands that we haven't seen that come out of, maybe you could say, the Bernie-crat wing of the party.
We haven't said anything about abortion rights. Isn't that a huge issue this year?
Yes, so the abortion messaging performs fairly well. In our poll, support for Harris relative to Trump, the average, there was 8.1% plus for Harris with strong populist messaging, whereas it was only plus 3.1 for the strong messaging around defend abortion. In general, I think the findings are that Democratic Party candidates would be better off foregrounding strong economic populist messaging. And that's not to say we shouldn't care about abortion, we shouldn't care about a million other important issues. But the question is, what should be the core of your appeal and message? Should your message be a populist message that then incorporates policies supportive of reproductive rights? Or it should be a message primarily on a cross-class appeal to all women around defending abortion that's pretty agnostic or at least vacillating on a lot of these key economic questions. And I think the answer is clearly the former, especially if you're concerned about winning over demographics that the Democratic Party has been losing for years, which are, you know, working class white men.
What did you think about Michelle Obama's speech over the weekend in Kalamazoo, which was this passionate call to protect women's reproductive health care and urged women to talk to the men in their lives about appreciating how important this was?
Yeah, I mean, I think Democrats did great in the midterms with a message that very heavily focused on abortion rights. I think Michelle Obama, as a famous surrogate, is going to do speeches that speak to her experience as a woman, that speaks to demographics that are most swayed by her. So it makes perfect sense. I'm not advocating against that. I think in general, the campaign should orient itself around bread and butter issues. I don't necessarily think it makes sense for Michelle Obama to be the one railing against the millionaire and billionaire class. It's not an either or, but I think where it does become something of a zero-sum game is the fact that the Democratic Party has continually based its appeal primarily on seeking the support of professional class voters and seeking the support of discrete identity-based demographics instead of trying to rebuild a broad-based national majority rooted in working class votes. Abortion rights would be far more secure with a Democratic Party that has a supermajority than with a Democratic Party that's out of power. And the message is pretty clear that a strong populist rhetoric is the most effective way to build these majorities.
The findings of this study that the working class is most won over by strong populist economic messaging is not unique to Democrats. Republicans, of course, could learn something from this. And in fact, many Trump strategists have been urging him to make his message a populist economic one and to blame Kamala and the Democrats in Washington specifically for the high costs of food and housing. Is that what we are seeing now from Trump in his closing?
So in 2016, the Trump message was heavily an economic message. He really went out of his way to speak to the grievances of working class people in a very direct bread and butter way. And yes, there was tons of racism and xenophobia, but it only worked because he led with this economic message. Now it seems like Trump is getting more and more invested in this culture war. Now, I think that there are certain thorny and difficult issues in which the American people might not be where certain liberal activists are, for example, on the issue of trans women in sporting competitions, on debates around youth gender medicine and so on. But when it comes to the actions of adults and people who, you know, say they want to be themselves and live in peace and dignity, I think this is a framing that when the issue comes up, the Democrats do far, far better on.
You know, the closing message that I've seen from Trump in ads on TV, especially during the World Series, is not about the high cost of food and housing. It's about trans people. They run a clip from Kamala in her what turns out to be her 2019 presidential campaign, saying she would guarantee that transgender people who are in prison have access to gender-affirming care. And the Trump, some of these Trump ads conclude, crazy liberal Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you. And the Republican strategists have explained they understand trans rights is not a number one issue in America today, but they are specifically targeting young men with this ad. And they've spent tens of millions of dollars attacking trans rights in the last week, especially on sports events.
Definitely, Trump is trying to make this a culture war issue. I think that liberal organizations did Harris or any other Democratic candidate no favors pushing those questions to the forefront in 2019 and 2020. But I think the Harris message on a lot of these cultural issues in this presidential cycle is very much in line with where the American people are, which is progressive but not radical on a whole host of issues. Even abortion rights, the median 50-yard line for abortion rights in this country is probably around, you know, 14 weeks and very little restrictions at 14 weeks, and then progressively more restrictions than, you know, no late-term abortions. Like, that's where the American people stand. It's not quite what left-wing activists demanding free abortion on demand want, but certainly it's closer to that norm of generally available access to abortion than what Republican activists want, which is no abortion, no exception. And that's an issue where the Republicans come across as extremists.
You know, I do not think Trump's appeal is based on his messaging. I think it's based on what he represents. And that's something that is, you know, not articulated in his messaging, which is has a lot to do with preserving the power of white men. And for a lot of voters, Christian white men.
Yeah, I think that for some people, of course, that's what Trump represents. Trump represents a return to order and stability. But I think order and stability has been undermined in many different ways that people conflate together. So there's a lot of Black men, for instance, that are going to vote for Trump. Now, the easy answer to why they're voting for Trump is they're sucked into his sexist appeals and whatever else. But another way to think about it is the New Deal order promised progress and stability at the same time for millions of Black families. Deindustrialization hurt Black men disproportionately the most out of any group. So I think some of these nostalgic appeals, some of these calls to bring back jobs, some of these calls around tariffs, misguided as they are in Trump's economic proposals, I think they have some sort of bread and butter appeal for those men. I think the call to order is also a call to community and purpose. And I think the Democrats haven't been speaking to the yearning for purpose that so many young men feel. I mean, we have tens of thousands of men who commit suicide every year in this country. I think you do have a real crisis of meaning and belonging, where people ask, what does it mean to be a man, and does this world actually need men or need me? And I think Democrats need to give a compelling answer, and they need to give an answer in which working class people of all sexes, but working class men too, are protagonists in the future. They're helping to build America. They're going to have a purpose. We're going to need you working to support your family. We're going to help you find good employment so that you're working to support your family. We're going to need you in your communities, in your union halls, in your churches, whatever your civic engagement is. And I think Trump, to the extent that's true, I don't think it's a reactionary yearning, just a reactionary yearning. Obviously, there is a reactionary yearning in there. But I think some of it is a yearning for purpose and belonging, and that's what the Democrats need to offer in the future.
Great. You said a lot of black men are going to vote for Trump. I don't think it's a lot. I think it's a few. It's a lot of white men who are going to vote for Trump.
Yes, of course, it's a lot more, I would say. The trends are moving in the direction where black men are trending in the direction of not being a monolithic voting bloc for the Democratic Party. Now, among young black men, there's polls where she's polling around 60%. Among very young black men, age 18 to 22, she's polling only around 50%. So I think there's a problem with the Democratic Party and men, particularly young men, and this applies to black men too. And if you just have the narrative that it's just a problem with white men, then I think you're missing the trends overall. Because what's the last Democrat to win white men in a majority was what? Clinton, right? I don't think even Obama did, despite the fact that Obama won states like Indiana his first time around.
Finally, a lot of people are asking the big question, how come it's so close? 47, 48% of voters want Trump to win. How do you answer that question?
Biden's an incumbent presidency. I think there's some sort of fatigue with the incumbency. I think people have experienced inflation for the first time in a generation. It's happened under his watch. And while these things have happened, Biden's been unable or unwilling, or some combination of the two, to communicate with the American people. He hasn't been on TV. He hasn't been explaining, here's why inflation is going up, but here's the job numbers, and here's our plan for recovery. He hasn't been able to say, look what we've been doing with manufacturing jobs. He hasn't been able to say, the Teamsters didn't endorse me, but I bailed out their fund. Imagine if that happened to Trump. That would be his talking point. I bailed him out. I bail out the American worker. I don't care what a union bureaucracy has to say. That sort of messaging would be there with any leader who's an effective communicator. It would be there to some degree with Obama, with Clinton, or with Trump. Biden is very unique in how little he's been able to communicate to the American people.
A lot of our friends would say the reason it's so close is that she's a black woman. Don't you think there's some truth to that?
I mean, honestly, I think that's a net benefit for her, to be honest. Not among white men as a whole, but I think it's going to help with turnout and other stuff. There are some people in this country, many more people who would not vote for a woman than wouldn't vote for a black person. I do believe that. But I think a lot of these people are already in the Trump tent. Beyond that, we've had 12 years of Democratic Party rule. So if people feel like the economic recovery, the long recovery from 2008 through the pandemic through now, isn't really benefiting them as much as they think it should. Obviously, you could argue about whether they're mistaken or not with some macro level figures, but clearly people aren't feeling like the economy is as good as those headline figures are. And I think a lot of it has to do with the prices of some key commodities like housing. Again, I think Harris's policies are a lot better situated to actually resolve the supply problem, let's say with housing or a lot of these other issues. But Democrats really need to sell themselves on that. And they're very lucky the Republican Party has pushed too hard on abortion and some of these other issues. They're very lucky in a certain way that Trump has committed so many gaffes, and he hasn't positioned himself as a healer, or as I made some mistakes the first term around, but I'm going to do this. And women, don't worry, I disagree with my party. I'm willing to work with Democrats to find a middle ground on abortion. Or getting shot made me realize that I want to unite this country. Like, that was going to be the message of his RNC speech. That terrified me, that Trump getting shot and having seen Jesus and having a change of heart and becoming a good husband and a good man all of a sudden, you know, that would have really, we would have been in trouble. This would have been a 60-40 sort of election.
And that did last for 20 minutes of his speech.
Yeah. And then it went on for another 2.5 hours.
So what do you think is going to happen next week?
I think Harris is actually going to win. I think she might win in an interesting way. I think there's a chance she's going to squeak by in the swing states thanks to her money advantage and the ground game advantage. And she might even be in a dead heat with the popular vote. I think eventually she's going to win the popular vote once all the California votes come in. But the fact that I'll even give the slight edge to Harris really tells you something about the kind of campaign that Trump has won. I mean, getting a shot should help you. Like it really should. Somehow people have already forgotten. The guy got shot in the air and pumped his fist and it's already gone.
Bhaskar Sunkara, he's president of The Nation magazine. Bhaskar, thanks for talking with us today.
Great. Thanks a lot, John. Take care.
Republicans are a minority of voters. That's why, for many years, they have turned to vote suppression to try to win elections, including various strategies on election day. And, of course, we have some MAGA groups threatening to create disruption and chaos at polling places in deep blue areas. The ACLU has been hard at work defending the right to vote and have the votes counted for a long time, and especially this year, and is prepared to deal with a wide variety of threats and problems in the voting and the vote counting. For that, we turn to Sophia Lynn Lakin. She's director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. She directs and supervises the ACLU's voting rights litigation strategy nationwide. For example, since 2021, the ACLU has participated in 29 redistricting cases. The record includes 14 wins, including 9 that impact next week's election. Sophia Lynn has testified on election law issues before Congress many times. She's a frequent commentator on MSNBC and in print. Sophia Lakin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
When did you start planning for Election Day in 2024?
The day after January 6th. I think we started to lay the groundwork for what is our nationwide strategy today.
The ACLU Action Plan for Safeguarding the Election lays out 28 scenarios for different problems, starting with problems with voter registration and voting itself, and ending with problems on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2025. We're especially interested right now in Election Day, election night, in the couple of days of vote counting after that. Early voting in person and by mail has been going on for a while now. As of the 1 week before Election Day, something like 50 million people have already voted. How has early voting gone so far from your perspective?
Well, I'm glad to say that it seems like, just based on the number of people who have turned out and cast their ballots, that it has been going well. It's a testament, I would say, to the work that so many people have done, including elections officials themselves, all of our partner organizations, all the people, and the voters themselves.
Most people's biggest fear about Election Day is voter intimidation or violence. Do you consider that the number one threat?
I think it's a very serious threat, and I understand why. Nobody wants to encounter intimidation or violence at any point in their lives, but it's really a concern at the voting booth when you are trying to express your preferences for how you want this country to be run. That's the kind of issue that you want to be able to address in the moment right away. And while I'm a litigator by trade, I like to bring lawsuits and go into court. That kind of intimidation or violence, you want to be able to respond right away. It's something that's not as suited for a court response in that moment. So, you know, preparing for that, ensuring that voters feel safe and that they're not afraid to go to the polls, I think that's one of my biggest concerns.
The next problem is violence or threats directed not at voters, but after the polls close, threats to the vote counting, to the vote tabulation centers. We remember the attack on the vote tabulation center in Miami in 2000. It was called the Brooks Brothers Riot because the middle-aged Republican men who attacked that center had the goal of stopping the recounting of votes in a Democratic county. They were well-dressed, so we call it the Brooks Brothers Riot. They did succeed in shutting down the recount before it was finished. What is the ACLU plan for protecting the counting of votes? This is your scenario 13, count stop due to intimidation or violence.
There's been so much proactive work that's been done in terms of engaging with elections officials, with state elections officials, with law enforcement as well, right, to discuss what their plans are for ensuring that vote counting centers are secure, that people are able to get their job done, that we are monitoring for threats in advance to try to diffuse them before they happen.
A related threat is direct threats to the ballots, stolen ballots, seized ballots, tampered ballots, destroyed ballots. There's one report from Vancouver, Washington. This is in the southwestern corner of the state, of one drop box that was set on fire, destroying a couple of hundred ballots. This is mostly a matter for the local police, but I'm sure you have thought about it.
Unfortunately, we have thought about it. And it's, again, another area where people have been really preparing to ensure that these things don't happen in the first instance. Of course, we're starting to see, unfortunately, people engaged in activity of this nature. I think it's hard to go into too much detail about the responses. It'll depend a little bit on each state and their laws, the specific issue. There may be backups in certain places, opportunities to do a limited chase to impacted voters, which I believe that the Washington elections officials are engaged in trying to get folks to cast a new ballot if their ballot has been destroyed. But I think it's a call to voters as well. You know, if you're a male voter, there are ways that you can track your ballot, make sure that it's made its way through the process, ways to ensure that if there are an issue, that there's an opportunity for you to be able to fix that or cast a provisional ballot and make sure that that ballot counts. So be careful, be watchful. But again, know that people have been preparing for this and thinking about it and looking to make sure that everybody's vote is counted.
The vote counting ends with what we call certification, the official statement of the final results. Some MAGA officials have said they will refuse to certify their results if they favor Harris, in an effort to confuse or delay declaring her the winner of the election. The Brookings Foundation has named 11 counties in four swing states where county officials who support Trump have threatened to refuse to certify elections in their counties. This is Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. I know you've litigated this already with very successful results in Georgia. Where do we stand on this issue today?
So there have been a number of really good, positive rulings. We have a state court ruling that is in place right now saying and making clear that under Georgia state law, certification is a mandatory duty. It's not a discretionary one. That's great, and that is correct. We also have two court orders, actually, at the state court level, at the trial court level, stating that a number of the state election board rules that would have given local election officials, I think, some discretion, unfortunately, to delay or disrupt the election, including a rule requiring hand counting of the ballots on election night. We have those two state court rulings saying that these rules violate state law and that the state election board did not have the authority to pass those rules. There had been an attempt to get those rules reinstated for this election, even though they've been blocked permanently by a state trial court. And the Georgia Supreme Court rejected that effort, which is great news. It means these rules will not be in place for this election and that they will not disrupt, gum up, delay the certification process.
So mostly here we've talked about threats of violence, refusal by officials to follow the law. There's also, of course, plans by the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee to file dozens of lawsuits in places where Kamala Harris has been declared the winner. They've already filed dozens of lawsuits. They filed dozens of lawsuits in 2020, all of which failed, but they're promising to try to do better this time. What are the plans for countering those lawsuits from the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee?
Not necessarily from the campaign, but the number of anti-voter, anti-voting, anti-election process lawsuits is over 130, maybe even more at this point. There's new ones being filed all the time. And the vast majority, just as they were in 2020, are frivolous, based on baseless claims, unsupported allegations, speculation, and have been time and time again, and even through this process, and certainly in the 2020 process, been thrown out quite quickly by the various courts that they've been put in front of. And in large part, I think they are aimed at sort of pushing a counter narrative that there is something wrong, to create an opportunity to potentially take advantage of uncertainty in the process and potentially create enough chaos or enough disruption to possibly change the outcome. So we at the ACLU have a particular lens when it comes to this litigation. We care very deeply about the point of view of the voter. You know, at the end of the day, I think there's a balance. There's a fine balance between giving oxygen to claims that are baseless, to claims that are frivolous, and ensuring that there's a quick resolution so that we can get through this election process.
Maybe we should just make it clear here that while I've been talking about electing Kamala Harris as our next president, this is not the goal of the ACLU Voting Rights Project.
That's absolutely correct. Again, we are here to make sure that every eligible voter has the ability to cast a ballot, have that ballot counted, and have that ballot respected, no matter who is ultimately the choice of that voter. Again, that's the lens that we bring to our decisions about whether to engage in litigation and whose voices we try to uplift.
And let's be clear that the responsibility for protecting the right to vote lies ultimately with the Justice Department, and they too have been planning for this probably as long as you have, since, you know, for 4 years. In 2021, Attorney General Garland created an elections threat task force that includes the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the Postal Inspection Service, since threats are come through the mail, and cybersecurity agencies. And of course, most of the responsibility for running elections is at the county level, and it's governed by state laws. So this is a matter for governors, state police, county sheriffs, and I am encouraged by the fact that 5 of 6 swing states have Democratic governors: Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, and North Carolina. And the last one, Georgia, has a governor, Brian Kemp, who has stood up for the independent actions of the Georgia vote count in defiance of Trump for 4 years ago. So it's not just the ACLU that has to do this job. There are government agencies that you work with and appeal to in these cases.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a critical point. Much of the work is laying the groundwork, making sure that we are able to plug in, I would say leverage, what the elections officials, what state AGs, what governors, what county elections officials, what the DOJ may already be doing, that we are, I could say, amplifying all the efforts across the board. And not just the ACLU, but all partner organizations that we work with.
Let's talk about that. The ACLU isn't the only group working with this. You have wonderful partners in different places. Who are the most important partners that you work with?
Well, I mean, there's so many, which is absolutely amazing. On the litigation side, you know, we work quite a bit with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law on both litigation, but again, on the election protection hotline for the voters out there, right? 1-866-OUR-VOTE. If you have problems on election day, you have a question, This is a number to call, and we are staffing this along with many of our partner organizations. But in the litigation side, we partner with the Lewis Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law quite a bit, the Legal Defense Fund, Latino Justice, ALDEF, MALDEF, Campaign Legal Center, Protect Democracy. I could go on and on. There's quite a few. The Brennan Center, who has provided a ton of resources, both for elections officials about, you know, the different laws and rules and things like that out there, but also for voters themselves if they want to know a little bit more. But we have a ton of partners who are working also on the voter mobilization side, the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, the NAACP. There's so many, and I hope that no one is offended that I have not named their names, but it is quite remarkable, I would say, the number of civic organizations that are engaged in the enterprise of ensuring that people are able to vote, that the process runs smoothly, that everyone feels secure, and that we have this covered.
Any concern about threats from the left? If you read the right-wing press, it's all about Antifa is mobilizing to disrupt the election. What's your view?
We're concerned about violence or intimidation, no matter where it comes from. It's unacceptable, no matter where it's coming from.
One good sign about this year's voting, nearly 80% of voters trust that the 2024 presidential election results will be accurate. And this includes a majority of Republicans, a majority of independents, as well as Democrats. So this is despite Trump's efforts to create doubt about the accuracy of the results. 80% of Americans expect the results to be accurate. This is a significant improvement over just 2 years ago, when about 70% of the voters said they had confidence in the results of the midterm election. So it seems like you, your partners, the Justice Department have done a good job in not only assuring the safety of the vote, but of persuading the public that the vote count is going to be accurate.
That is great news. I'd love to hear. Let's get to 100%, although I know that may be hard. I mean, that'd be hard. But, you know, I think it is absolutely a testament to all the work that's been done. I think a recognition that faith in these elections, faith in the outcomes of the election, is such a big piece of being a democracy. And there's more to do, and we'll continue to do that. But this is one of my biggest concerns, if people lose faith and they don't continue to participate and engage in the long term. And so that makes me feel good.
Sophia Lynn Lakin is director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. Sophia, thank you for all your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is executive producer. Dede Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. And you can subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Legislation is changing. Budgets are shifting, and terms like one big beautiful bill can feel anything but beautiful. That's where BHM CPA Group steps in. BHM's purpose is to simplify the complex. Their team is trained to meet today's challenges with real-world solutions in tax, accounting, and business planning. Get the clarity you deserve so that your business can thrive. Don't wait. Visit bhmcpagroup.com. That's bhmcpagroup.com. BHM, because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. and Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.